Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? No matter what kind of farm fresh food you want to find in your home fridge these days, what comes first is the Good Eggs Network. On this week's show, we talk with Tess Monahan and Simone Reggie of the local Good Eggs Network to hear how they're making the connection between farm and fridge closer and easier than ever before. Then Ryan Hughes, our culinary consultant, drops by with an intriguing ingredient, Botarga. Wait till you hear what that is and how to use it. And it's also time for a Chinese New Year celebration. Author Audra Ang is here to share stories from her book, To the People, Food is Heaven. It's all fresh talk on this week's Louisiana Eats. Good Eggs has tremendous ambition. After arriving in Louisiana last year, the online food aggregator has grown by leaps and bounds. They've moved into a new warehouse, hired employees, and hugely expanded their visibility in the New Orleans area. On a chilly winter morning, we arrived at the Good Eggs warehouse to speak with Simone Reggie and Tess Monahan about their plans to link consumers, purveyors, and distributors through their online network.
2 years ago in San Francisco, our founders got together with some local farmers to see what was a challenge that they were facing. And they said since it's such a technology and internet-based world, they could come up with some sort of software where people could order their products and then they could handle the delivery. And so that worked beautifully for them. And then about a year later, they followed up and said, how is it going? I said, it's great. It's just we don't have time to deliver. So if you could possibly aggregate the orders and deliver them for us, that would be great. So hence an internet company turned into a distribution company. All these vendors drop their orders off here. We aggregate them and deliver them either to your house or to different pickup points throughout the city. Or you can pick it up right here at our warehouse.
How many pickup points are you up to now?
Probably 8 or 10. We're just launching a couple new ones this week. Actually, just recently we launched Raw Republic as a pickup spot. So we drop off orders there, and then you can go by and pick up your Good Eggs order and grab a juice to drink then or some juice to take home. We have also had a lot of success having local wine shops as pickup spots. We need an uptown wine shop now, too. But Faubourg Wine was one of our first pickup spots, and it's great because people, you know, you swing by, you pick up your groceries, you grab a bottle of wine, and you have everything you need for the evening. And we're really thrilled to have them on our team as well.
Good Eggs, as an entity within the United States, sure got some special attention at the end of 2012. Tell us about that recognition.
Meaning being named by BuzzFeed as the number one most important thing to happen for local food lovers, or food lovers in general, I think, of the year. That was a pretty sweet mention. To me, what that reflects is that people are starting to see that our food system needs to change. And the way we think about the kind of fundamental way that we feed ourselves is pretty broken in the United States. And I'm not sure we are the answer. You know, we are certainly not the only answer. But we are definitely pushing the envelope as far as encouraging people to think differently about where they spend their money on food. And so I'm hoping that as 2014 progresses, we see more and more people thinking about, well, yes, I could just go to the supermarket. I could just, you know, buy some organic food where, yes, it's organic, but it's owned by the same Nestle or Kraft or Unilever that owns all the non-organic brands also. And maybe is that where I want to put my money? Or in some way or another, do I want to put my money into the local economy and into the pockets of local farmers and food businesses?
You know, it is so interesting the way New Orleans commerce is just growing by leaps and bounds in a variety of huge ways. Like, nobody can believe how many restaurants there are. No restaurants closing. Everybody just opening. And about the same time that you all really got rolling
we got our first Costco. So give me the Costco versus Good Eggs comparison. There really isn't a comparison, is there?
It's pretty different. I think that all in all, more options are better for people. As far as big box stores go, Costco has a pretty great track record. They treat their employees well. They make an effort to get organic products and to source better than comparable stores. I don't think we're ever going to sell giant volumes of, you know, dish detergent or paper towels. So people are free to continue to go to Costco for their bulk staples. but I think that there's a growing awareness of, you know, okay, what things do I want to buy from the mass market system and what things do I want to buy from sources where I really know, you know, really know where the food is coming from, really know where the product is coming from.
Yeah, I definitely think that's what sets us apart from any grocery store in town is that you can, when you go on the site, you look and you see, like, I am buying a pie from Nate the Pie Guy, or I am buying milk from the Motes, and you know exactly who they are. You can click on their link. It tells their story. So it gives you that personal connection to your food. Like, I know Tess posted a picture last night on Instagram, and there have been so many times where I've done it where I look down at my plate and I personally know every single person involved in that whole meal. And it's a complex meal. It's not like two ingredients. It's like 15 ingredients. There's something rewarding about that. There's something different about that than any other experience that you have.
That has been, you know, it's sort of like the song that Alice Waters began singing all those years ago at Chez Panisse, you know your farmer, know your food. Mm-hmm. And when you think of the level of that number, 15 ingredients on your plate, and you know everybody who touched that food, it kind of touches your heart, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, I know the relationship that our meat farmers have with their animals. And days like today where we've had a freeze, it's you feel for them because you know that it's a struggle.
I have a logistics question because in some ways you all are really like a grocery store now, but all the ordering has to be done online first. So what if suddenly you're hungry for some of Dan S.'s puttanesca sauce, how quick can you get your hands on it?
Ordering is typically 32 hours in advance. So that means you order by midnight Sunday, let's say, for Tuesday delivery, midnight Monday for Wednesday delivery, etc.
And that doesn't change for pickup here?
No, it's the same because almost all of our products are what we call just-in-time fulfillment, which means that it's a really amazing system that reduces a lot of waste because what it means is, you know, if Tim has 3 heads of broccoli for order today, he is going to pick those 3 heads of broccoli this morning, or maybe he picked them last night, but it's not even like a farmer's market where you're going to pick 20 heads of broccoli and then maybe 5 of them will sell, or maybe none of them will sell, or maybe 20 will sell. So a lot of what we're doing is reducing waste by just making sure that we're only bringing into our warehouse exactly what's already been sold. There's so much waste in our food system. Grocery stores create so much food waste. A lot of the time it's products that are, you know, just one day before their expiration date, so they can't use them. Even though the product's still good, they can't sell it. So what we're trying to do, in addition to creating connections between local farmers and the customer, is reduce food waste in the system and create a more efficient distribution system.
Since Good Eggs started in California and you all are part of a larger organization, would you talk to me a little bit about how the business model works in that how much is from inspiration and instruction from California, and how much are you all growing locally, organically, here at Good Eggs in New Orleans?
So the team in California, we're extremely lucky that they have a large engineering team that created a lot of software resources for us. So fundamentally, the way that we're able to do what we do in an efficient way is because of this amazing software that the team has built, which allows customers to place orders online and then provides a whole lot of tools on the back end for us to see the orders as they come in, for the farmers to manage their orders, for us to be able to say, okay, this is the delivery route for today, this is how many delivery drivers we're going to need. And without that software, we would not be able to do what we're doing. That's a big part of why we're successful. As far as, you know, the day-to-day operations, we are clearly very much in talks with the San Francisco office, you know, every day, every week. We have teams here that have counterparts in San Francisco. So, for example, Simone is the lead of our food maker team here. There's a food maker team in every city. There's one in Los Angeles. There's one in New York. And a lot of things, a lot of the challenges that our food makers, our farmers, and our food producers face locally are echoed in the other cities. But we also have unique challenges. So I would say that our relationship with the headquarters in San Francisco is very supportive. They really support us. They're there to build tools that will make us succeed, make us be able to support our local food system better. There have been very few times when they've said, no, you can't do this, or yes, you must do this. It's been a pretty smooth course of action.
What do you expect is coming next from Good Eggs?
So our engineering team in California, right now their big project is building a mobile app. So we will very soon have an iPhone and Android app that will make it easier to shop online from your phone. About 25% of our site traffic is from smartphones, but our current website, it works on a smartphone, but it's not optimized for a smartphone. So we're going to have a great mobile site launching, hopefully in the next couple of weeks. We would like to continue to expand our delivery radius and just keep adding more convenient pickup and delivery options for people so they can get their food in a way that's really convenient for them.
Yeah, it's been really exciting. Recently, we've launched into Metairie and Algiers. And so that's been huge. And people have really been receptive to that. So as soon as we get the word out, more and more people can have... Because there's no farmer's market in Metairie.
Right.
And so this is perfect for the people of Metairie, I think.
Well... Thank you so much for letting us come over here, meet the vendors, see the food coming in the door, and really get a hands-on experience about how the whole Good Eggs program really works. Congratulations.
Thank you, Poppy.
Thank you for coming to visit us.
That was Tess Monahan and Simone Reggie of Good Eggs, an online food aggregator in Louisiana. More information is available online at goodeggs.com/NOLA. With all the Good Eggs talk this week, it seemed timely to talk about what makes an egg a good egg. A perfectly fresh egg fills its shell almost completely. As the egg ages, air manages to work its way through the shell, creating an ever-growing airspace. That's why, if you're boiling eggs, it's a good idea to use older ones. That way, once they're cooked, they'll peel easier because of that pocket of air. To keep eggs good, they have to be refrigerated, so no leaving them out on the counter. And if you have any concern about whether an egg that's been around for a while is still fresh enough to eat, just put the raw eggs in a bowl filled with water. Any eggs that are too old to eat will float. The ones still fresh will stay on the bottom of the bowl. That's how to make sure all your eggs are good eggs, a trick home cooks have been using for centuries. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. When we come back from a short break, we'll hear from some of the Good Eggs vendors and learn just how this amazing new distribution system is growing their boutique businesses by leaps and bounds. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. It's been less than a year since the San Francisco-based website Good Eggs launched in New Orleans. And just as they're getting their feet placed on solid ground, so are so many of their vendors. As we toured the new facility on Chapultepec, several producers arrived to drop off their goods and spoke with us about their evolving relationship with Good Eggs.
I'm Sheena Menina. I'm from New Orleans, and I own Raw Republic, which is a cold-pressed juice shop. Our relationship to Good Eggs is we are a marketplace provider. We provide all of our juices, smoothies, and cleanses on the Good Eggs marketplace, and we also serve as a pickup location for our Good Eggs Uptowners on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday, I believe, from 4 to 6. We're Good Eggs all the way around. You know, I hope to encourage consumers to use Good Eggs for all of its aspects. I hope that we can be a great resource for Good Eggs, and at the same time, a lot of our consumers want to have vegetation in their refrigerators. They want to have local meats in their refrigerators, local dairies, and the health implications of buying local and organic are so incredible that we encourage all of our customers to check it out. It makes eating healthy so much easier and so much fun. You can spend more time walking your dog and things and not worry about going to the grocery anymore. And at the same time, you're supporting all of your amazing local businesses. So we are the biggest Good Eggs advocates. New Orleans is so exciting. The entrepreneurship, the new businesses, the local vibe all at the same time. I mean, we're such an exciting place right now, and I'm so excited to be a part of it. And Good Eggs helps to bring that community together. They source those people who are doing things that are exciting. Maybe they're smaller, maybe they're niche and things like that. But then they're bringing them to such a large community of people all around, so supportive and amazing. So I'm really happy to be a part of Good Eggs and this community, for sure. I feel so lucky and blessed.
By collaborating with Good Eggs, up-and-coming businesses like Sheena's have found a place to incubate their product and grow their customer base. But it doesn't stop with boutique added-value products. Word of mouth is spreading among North Shore farmers who have found a new avenue of distribution into the city.
I'm Tim Roper from Stony Point Farms here at Good Eggs in New Orleans. We went on board with Good Eggs about 5-6 months ago. It was the end of our summer season. We do a lot of watermelons, corns, and Good Eggs came to New Orleans. Bridget, my daughter, dragged me over to meet with them. I wasn't too keen about the idea of selling produce online, but I jumped on board, and we have done nothing but explode. Every week it gets bigger, and today I brought in the largest order I've ever had. And we do the Abita Springs Market every Sunday in Abita Springs. And every time we go there, we make a big show. We make sure the tables are full. We have lots of produce, rain, shine. I mean, we're always there. So there's these producers that are close to us, and the goal is this is a way for them to sell their product. You know, they'll show up at the market. They'll sell a couple carrots or a radish, and they have a lot that will go to waste. I said, look, man, you got to get with Good Eggs, come to the market on Sunday, sell your products, and then fill your orders on Monday or Tuesday here. Bring it into the city. So that's our communications. Link these small farmers together. This is the mechanism of the vehicle that will get them to make their farm look profitable. And then people are excited. It's for people who are passionate. It's just like the people that are cooking and preparing and pickling the products here online. They're all passionate about it. And that's the same thing on the producer end. The benefit Good Eggs brings to the table for a farmer in my place is they'll take a small producer. So if I'm growing 12 cabbage, I can actually bring 12 cabbage to the marketplace. It allows me to micro farm and get it to the market at a reasonable price. So you have a lot of small producers grow a lot of variety of different things, but they start harvesting and say, well, what do I do with this or that? And it doesn't look like a lot, but when you start breaking it down, they're the answer. They're the technology that allows me to get it to the marketplace. They cover the logistics. And they eliminate our farm waste. I have an enormous amount of waste on our farm. All farms do. When we go out and pick radishes, you know, we pick an order for radishes. Well, you got a lot of radishes you have to thin out. What do you do with them? So we can bring them to the marketplace here. I mean, we do a produce bundle. It changes what you get in your grocery bag. When I thin the carrots, I have a lot of carrots that normally chickens eat. They're great carrots, but I'll give you a produce bundle. And we do a produce bundle that's $20. that's equivalent to, if you went to a local grocery store, would cost you somewhere around $47. So I'm actually feeding you good, naturally grown products at a reasonable price. In other words, that every American can afford, right? Right? Yeah.
Those are testimonials from some of the vendors of Good Eggs New Orleans. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Louisiana Eats culinary consultant Ryan Hughes always has some new international flavor that's making an appearance on his plate. So, Ryan, what have you got today?
Well, Poppy, what I brought today is Botarga.
Now, that's an ancient Italian thing, right?
That's correct. It's popular in the coastal areas of Italy, especially Sardinia, Sicily, Liguria, and Calabria. It's actually a egg sac from the striped mullet. Like a lot of things, especially in coastal fishing areas, they wanted to use all of the product itself, the fish, and so they would find ways of curing and pressing and salting and whatnot to use every part of the fish. So the way that they processed Botarga, or the egg sacs of the mullet, is they salted it first. It takes about 2 or 3 days, and they actually pack the roe sacs in salt. Actually, what happens is that extracts a lot of the water out of the egg sacs, and obviously water is the detriment to proteins and causes things to spoil. And then they press it between two pieces of wood, and it gives it this beautiful rectangular shape, and then they hang it. It hangs for about 3 to 4 weeks. And then to preserve it even more, they will take the pressed and hung roe sacs and dip it in a quick bath of beeswax.
Ah, so it's very stable and very preserved and doesn't even require refrigeration after that.
It does not. And the Botarga that you find here in the United States, it actually comes vacuum sealed in packs.
Cool. And what does it taste like?
Well, what I want you to do, Poppy, is I brought a little bit with us.
Okay.
And I'm going to grate a little bit right here. Let me see what you think about this.
Okay.
Right,
it's gone from sort of a deep orange color. It's really now a beautiful bright yellow.
It's a beautiful bright yellow, and that's what I like about it so much. The Italians use it in pasta, fresh pasta. Actually, they just use, it's called spaghetti a la Botarga. And it pairs really well. Once you taste it, it's got kind of, I don't want to say it's fishy at all. Here, try a little bit, Poppy.
It's very interesting because it's also very aromatic.
You can smell it too, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a really lovely sort of seafood scent that's in the room that's come off of it.
Exactly. It's really interesting. It goes back to one of our favorite conversations we have together, me and you, Poppy, and that's using that body salt flavor that we like so much in dishes.
Just like an anchovy.
Just like an anchovy.
It's not quite as salty, and it's really a lot creamier and milder than I think people would expect.
I'll be quite honest and let you know now that last night I made a Botarga pizza.
Boy, I bet that was good.
It was so good. I used fresh dough with mozzarella straight out of the oven and just grated it right there with some fresh arugula at the very end. And it just added, like, you know, along the same lines we were talking about, like anchovies and pizzas or something like that, and that body salt flavor.
So for our Louisiana Eats listeners that might want to try this experiment themselves, how in the world can you find this ingredient?
It's kind of up-and-coming ingredient that just a lot of us chefs use right now. You can find it in some of the markets on the West Coast and in New York and whatnot. But the best way I know to get it, the company that actually produces it, it's called the Anna Maria Fish Company out of Cortez. You can look it up online, and they've got a great little website. It's cute. It's kind of old school. You know, they want to focus on actually fishing and producing.
Yes.
And you can order it straight through them.
Oh, that is fabulous. Well, thank you so much for introducing the Louisiana Eats listener to something brand new in America, but very old in Europe.
Thanks, Poppy.
Chef Ryan Hughes of the New Orleans Pop-Up Purlieu, our Louisiana Eats culinary consultant. Public radio contributor Ian McNulty covers the restaurant scene for the New Orleans Advocate and is the author of Louisiana Rambles, an off-the-beaten-path exploration of our state's heartland. Ian, where have you been rambling lately?
Well, hi, Poppy. Today we're going to take a trip high on the Cajun Prairie in Acadiana. We're going to a restaurant called D.I.'s. It's the initials of the founder, Daniel Isaac. He and his wife, Sherry, have run this restaurant for, going on 30 years almost.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Now, this is a place. It's in Basile, which is a really small, old Cajun farming town on Highway 97, kind of better known as the Evangeline Highway out there. Smack between I-10 and Highway 190, the two sort of meridians going through Louisiana there. It looks like it's in the middle. When you're on this highway, it's just rice fields, rice fields, rice fields. But is it in the middle of nowhere? After visiting a few times, I figured out that for this restaurant, it's actually right in the middle of the action. This is a Louisiana seafood restaurant specializing in crawfish. So being in the middle of these endless fields of rice, which double, of course, as crawfish fields.
Of course.
Is like, sort of like being in the middle of a stockyard for a steakhouse. I mean, all the raw materials that this place works with are right there.
And
that,
well, what a great analogy. Love that.
So you have to imagine this place. You're coming down the highway. You have it in mind. You've got directions. Even when you know where you're going, you're going to start to doubt it. And then suddenly this place emerges, a big sign on the side of the road and a really big restaurant. One of these places that looks like a barn that just kept growing and growing and growing. And what we have today is really this pretty big dining complex that doubles as a music venue and a dancing spot. And importantly, around Mardi Gras time, a real destination for people who are partying it up for that Cajun Mardi Gras style.
Cool.
Yeah. So you got to get a feel for the place. You drive in, dirt parking lot. You know, if you're not the first seating, you're probably going to wait just a little bit. And a really, you know, cool, family-friendly, casual interior with kind of the what I consider the main room to be around the stage, plank floors, big long tables, rafters. There's bands there Thursday through Saturday. So there's, you know, music and dancing. And a really fun crowd. And people just seem to materialize out of the fields, frankly, to converge on this place once the dinner bell starts ringing.
And when the dinner bell rings, what's for dinner?
Well, seafood, of course. Boiled crawfish in season, shrimp and crabs throughout. And, of course, lots of fried seafood, particular to their oysters on horseback. Excuse me, they call them angels on horseback.
Angels on horseback, which some of us know as oysters on brochette.
Right, for sure. But they also have devils on horseback, which are a shrimp version of that.
Really?
Yeah, shrimp or oysters, in that case, wrapped in bacon, fried up, really good. This is one of those places that does the sort of like a sampler of everything. If you get the crawfish platter, you're going to get a touffee, fried crawfish, boiled crawfish, a crawfish bisque. Same kind of idea with the shrimp platter. It's just sort of like a world tour of Cajun recipes along that seafood line. So lots of gumbos, crab soup, and interestingly, a corn and crawfish chowder. They call it a chowder. It's sort of like what you might think of as a crab and corn soup, but with crawfish. Pretty good stuff there. And raw oysters out there. You can get them fried or blackened too. So big portions, but of course the boiling operation is really the heart and soul of this place, just as it started out as. So a really fun place, and it can really get cooking on those weekend nights when people start coming in. You'll find limousines in the parking lot next to big trucks, next to beater cars. I've seen little motor coaches come pulling up, like people taking outings out to DI's on the prairie, coming in from Lafayette or wherever they're coming from. And one advantage of being out there surrounded by fields is they've been known to have airplanes land right nearby.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So even the high rollers fly in.
Yeah, little crop dusting planes, stuff like that. They'll come in. There's a little runway next to the restaurant that they use for agriculture. And people have been known to land their planes there. In fact, if you go onto their website, you can find aerial coordinates for finding this if you happen to be just, you know, buzzing around the skies of Acadiana and interested in some crawfish.
Well, I am so grateful that you could go out and find the center of the crawfish world and bring it home to us. Thank you, Ian.
Oh, it's a wonderful treat. Thank you.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Ian McNulty. What's the secret to a perfectly hard-boiled egg? When we come back from the next short break, we'll answer that question and make sure that all of your boiled eggs are good eggs. Stay tuned. I'm on my way to New Orleans this morning. I'm Poppy Tooker. And you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. This week's culinary quiz, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute, is how do you correctly hard-boil eggs? Overcooking a boiled egg causes the iron in the yolk to combine with the sulfur in the egg white, producing hydrogen sulfide, resulting in that discouraging gray ring around the hard-boiled yolk. Here's how to cook perfect hard-boiled eggs. Place the eggs in a saucepan and cover with water. As soon as they come to a boil, set the timer for 7 minutes. When the timer goes off, immediately drain the eggs and run cold water over them until they're cool. The cold water produces a layer of steam between the egg and the shell, making peeling them very easy. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Audra Ang worked for nearly a decade as the Beijing correspondent for the Associated Press. During that time, she observed the dramatic changes going on in industrial centers and rural areas, documenting them in her memoir, To the People, Food is Heaven. To celebrate the Chinese New Year, Audra's here to discuss how ancient food traditions are changing as China evolves into a world superpower. So, Audra, in your book, you devote two entire chapters to foods that China is pretty much internationally recognized for, tea and Peking duck. Now, I thought we could start talking about the tea tradition first, because it is said to have roots that go back over 5,000 years in China. Explain the cultural importance of tea.
I always tell people I'm an eater, not a cooker. So a lot of the things, like, I just kind of experienced there, but I really had to do a ton of research while actually writing the book. So to me personally, what I experienced in the non-academic setting is just how pervasive tea is. It's something that's almost always offered to you when you go to someone's home, especially in the villages. But I just felt there were so many facets to tea drinking. It's not just a beverage, but, you know, it's a way for people to make you feel at home. For one thing, I didn't realize that tea, I mean, the kind of tea I love the best is jasmine tea. I thought there was a jasmine tea plant. That's how ignorant I was. But it's really, you know, it's really the basic green tea leaf, and then you infuse it with the flavors of the jasmine flowers. Things like that I learned through my tea lady, who was absolutely awesome.
Audra, I was fascinated to learn and tell everybody, how has that Chinese term that means make tea, how has that come to stand for dissident?
Oh, it wasn't actually make tea, it's to drink tea, actually. The characters are slightly different. And so once in a while, you even get reporters who are asked to have a cup of tea with authorities.
And that's the thing to be really afraid of right now.
Yeah,
exactly. If you're in China and somebody in a uniform says, let's have a cup of tea, run, right?
Exactly. And sometimes they're not even in uniform. They're like plain clothes. But yeah, you shouldn't run because that could be worse for you. But yeah, again, it depends, you know, on the situation and who you are. But I've heard foreign reporters, they actually do go to a tea house or, you know, meet somewhere and actually have a cup of tea. And then they'll kind of gently ask what you're doing and what stories you've been writing. And kind of it's a very semi-civilized form of interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a Chinese dissident, a lot of times there's no tea. You know, you just kind of another way to say, you know, you're being taken in for a questioning. But generally, the drink a cup of tea thing is you do come back, you know, but it serves usually as a warning when you're doing something that the authorities aren't happy about. So they tell you what they would prefer you do over a cup of tea. Yeah.
Peking duck is also quite an ancient tradition, and you cite that it might date back to 400 A.D., but its real popularity actually came about 900 years later at the hands of a court physician and dietitian. So talk to us about that Peking duck, and what about stuffing the innards with sheep's stomach, cilantro, and scallions?
I know, that's pretty crazy. It's hard to tell if it was actually Peking duck in the form that we know it today, but there were references to roast duck that was mentioned in this book called The Principles of Correct Diet, or that's the translation, written in 1330 by this court physician. And this whole tome was focused on nutrition and seasonal eating and hygiene, and it described this roast duck dish that was made by pulling out the innards of the duck before stuffing it with a mixture of sheep stomach, cilantro, scallions, and salt. And then the whole bird was speared on a fork and roasted over a charcoal fire. I'm assuming, you know, just from this, that, you know, it's something that would kind of have the balance of yin and yang, which is, or, you know, the heat and the nutrition that the Chinese culture is very much, you know, uses or talks about in its daily life.
Well, it's believed that Peking duck not only tastes delicious, but that it's medicinal as well. So what is it that the Peking duck is believed to do for you?
So the duck is supposed to be packed with protein, phosphorus, thiamine, iron, copper, zinc, and other trace elements, which the Chinese believe can help relieve a whole slew of ailments. And what I was talking about, the yin and yang, is kind of this concept. There are foods that are hot and there are foods that are cold. And so what you're trying to do is find a balance within your body of heat and cold. And so basically, the meat is considered quote-unquote cold. So it's supposed to, you know, clear out the lungs and nourish the blood and help with bruises and headaches and insomnia and coughs and fevers. So the things like cucumbers and scallions, they kind of fall into the cold category too.
Yes.
So that, you know, would help with things like sore throats and promotes digestion and prevents colds and nourish the skin. But honestly, I have to say today, I doubt people actually think of that. They just eat it because it's yummy.
Well, what is your absolute best food memory of eating this iconic Chinese dish when you were actually in China?
So it's very political, or, you know, like joking. I say this, you know, as a joke. That's why China sometimes reminds me of, you know, the culture in Singapore, too, where everyone has really, really strong feelings about where they think you could get the best chicken rice. You know, that's in Singapore, or, you know, whatever local dish there is. But in Beijing, at least, it's kind of the same thing. You ask someone, you know, where is the best Peking duck? You ask 24 people, you probably get, you know, 24 answers. Or if not 24, you know, the people who are in one camp will, like, thoroughly disagree with the people in the other camp. So my favorite place is a place called Liqun, which is spelled L-I-Q-U-N. You know, the duck is, the skin's crispy and it's crackling because a lot of the fat has been rendered out and the meat's like really moist. And Peking duck, you know, it's traditionally eaten. You slice the duck skin into slivers and then you don't eat the meat actually. Oh, actually, sometimes you do. You cut up the meat, but the main point is to eat the skin, and then it's accompanied by, again, it depends on where you are, but sometimes, you know, a lot of a sweet bean paste. It depends on what it is, but I personally, I like it with just a plain pancake. It's wrapped in a flour pancake with some skin, a little bit of sweet sauce, and cucumbers. That's the way I like it. It's very, very simple, but you can pretty much put anything you want in there.
I'm wondering, I've seen a lot of recipes for Peking duck, but do you know anybody who does it at home, or do you do it at home?
Oh, God, no. I would never, ever try doing it at home, and the whole process is pretty involved. If you want to eat really traditional Peking duck, you still have to use it. You have to use a bicycle pump, for God's sake, you know, to separate the skin from the flesh. And actually, I think Mr. Lee, he actually, like, used his mouth. He actually blows instead of a bicycle pump. He blows into a raw duck, you know?
Wow.
And again, nothing I would ever want to attempt.
So, wow.
No, and I don't know anyone who does that. I mean, it's so much easier and a lot more fun just to go to a place and get someone else to do the cooking and just pig out.
When Americans think about food production in China, Audra, I think the first thing that comes to their mind is all the poisoning and horror stories. So it really shocked me. For one thing, China is second only to Australia in the amount of land set aside for organic farming. I hadn't really pictured it as a cradle of organic farming.
Yeah, and that, again, you know, is a figure I found while doing my research. But I think, you know, there have been huge strides made in the whole organic movement in China. But at the end of the day, it's still a really, really tiny portion of, well, there's two ways to look at it. In the consumer market, it's still a really tiny portion because, oddly enough, you know, Chinese people kind of like perfection. And organic food looks nothing like perfection. And so if you have, like, a hole-ridden leaf of vegetables, you know, or something like that, they don't really want to pay for that because they want things to look pretty. And things are also more expensive when it's organic. I mean, like, it is here. And so while there is a growing market, it's still pretty small. But organic farming, in a way, has been around since the beginning of time for the Chinese people. I mean, farmers usually, they farm, and then they have their own plot where they eat from their land. And so they use, you know, the way they farm, they don't use pesticides on the food they eat. So in a way, in the countryside, they've been doing that. There's no shift because they never really shifted away from that as much.
The Chinese countryside was a whole fascinating topic, and it shocked me that something that's really relatively new in Europe, and it's just kind of now getting a foothold in the United States, appears to have been thriving in China since the 1970s, what I think is commonly referred to as agritourism. Talk to us about that movement there.
Nowadays, you know, this thing called Nongjiala, which there are many translations, but it's kind of like happy country home is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers are trying to get in on the boom that, you know, the cities have felt, you know, and so one of the ways they're doing is opening up their homes
for visitors, yeah.
Yeah, for visitors, you know, so that they can stay in, you know, a quote-unquote real farm home for a night and have a real farm meal. And
well, describe for us your experience with Farmer Sun and his happy country home.
Oh, Farmer Sun. I feel like I'm idealizing a lot of this, but, you know, when you leave a place, you remember the good times, and even if it's a little more polished than it really was, you know, those are the things that are going to stay with me for a long time, and Farmer Sun's place was one of them. And, you know, we get there, and it's like the road to get there. It's like the usual bad traffic and smog, and then it's in the mountains. We get in the mountains, and slowly, you know, the city kind of, like, disappears into our rearview mirror, and the air is fresher, and it's greener, and finally, we get to Farmer Sun's home, and the first thing I notice after the driver turns off the engine is, you know, silence. I hear chicken in the distance, you know, that kind of thing, and it's like, oh, my God. And we get there, and Farmer Sun is this, like, tall, rangy man with kind of big ears and the biggest smile you've ever seen, and he's like, hello. It was just such a welcome change from the city, and I was about to leave Beijing at the time, so I was just kind of sad, and I was there with some friends, and it was just nice to have this wonderful, quiet weekend away. But, of course, for me, the best part was the food. And Farmer Sun and his wife, they cook everything from their backyard. Everything is from there. I think they buy maybe, they don't have pigs, so maybe they would buy pork from the store or the market, you know, but that's about it. And so, you know, I don't remember, I mean, I remember some of the stuff they cook, but for me, it's all, it will always be about the omelet. I don't know what makes it so perfect, but it's this, like, you know what it is? I think it's because they cook it in a wok. And in Chinese cooking, the wok just imparts this intangible smokiness to the food that you can't get in a regular American pan. Maybe the closest thing is a cast iron skillet, maybe, but, you know, the wok itself, you can talk a whole afternoon about it.
Well, one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you, aside from the fact that I'm a great fan of the book, is Chinese New Year. Would you explain the importance of this holiday in China?
So Chinese New Year is China's biggest and most celebrated holiday. I think it's actually 15 days long, and it depends on what day. You eat different things on different days. Chinese New Year Eve, you usually have something called a reunion dinner. Everyone sits around a table, and this is when you break out the best of the best. You have the most luxurious food you can afford. But on another day, you make dumplings, and that's where everyone sits around. You make homemade dumplings. And then another day, you have the glutinous rice ball in a soup, which is more dessert that's stuffed with, like, peanuts or black sesame or red bean paste. And so different days, you have different kinds of food. And it's generally, you know, it's to usher in the new year. And you have lion dances, and it's just one giant celebration, and a lot of it is centered around food.
And this really is the big holiday in China, right?
Yeah, it's the biggest day. I mean, and it's also like you have the longest. You don't actually get 15 days off, but, you know, usually you have about a week off. That's, you know, when usually everyone travels. And again, since it's a big celebration, it is the holiday.
Well, that was one of the things, you know, you're talking about New Year's Eve being the reunion meal. And so I guess that's because virtually everybody travels home to their birthplace to be with their families. And you describe this as the largest annual movement of humans on the planet. So what is it like to be in China during the midst of all this moving about and heading home?
Oh, God. Okay, so the first rule for me was that you never travel during Chinese New Year. I mean, if I did, I would usually travel outside of China. But now, you know, because a lot of Chinese are becoming a lot more wealthy, I mean, everyone kind of travels outside too. But it's really, really insane. I mean, airport, the lines are crazy. Everything's packed. Ticket prices are crazy. There's a certain period where they start selling tickets for Chinese New Year. And so people will line up at the train station, you know. It's like camping out for football season tickets or something. Or, you know, for Black Friday when people camp out at Best Buy, you know. It's the same thing, you know, you camp out for train tickets.
Well, I guess that really is an illustration of the importance of the family in China.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's very, very family-oriented. Yeah, it is. It does.
Audra, what do you perceive the future of China to be?
Your guess is as good as mine, honestly. I mean, I can't say that I have or will ever truly understand China. So much of it's because, you know, there isn't much transparency, but you just never know what's going to happen. And I mean, politically, it's hard to say, but I would hope that they would open up a little, but I'm not sure. I doubt that it will ever be, you know, a democratic society like in the U.S., although I'm sure that's debatable. But I don't think it will ever get there. But I think if they're going to open up economically, they have to somehow become a little more free politically. But I don't know what direction that's going to go in.
Well, I want to thank you so much for giving us this glimpse into the China of today. So thank you for taking the time to visit with us on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for being so open to learn, you know, all these things. It's just wonderful. And I had a great conversation with you. Thank you.
Audra Ng, author of the new book, To the People, Food is Heaven. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, Loretta Barrett Oden talks about the practical food sensibilities of her Native American people.
This food is as diverse as we are as Indian people. There are hundreds and hundreds of tribes. There are hundreds of mutually unintelligible languages. From region to region, from the Northwest Coast, the salmon, through the plains, the buffalo, the venison, the quail. But the food is very, very regional specific and quite delicious.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima and Lady Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state.
Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh, consulting producer Margaret Howes, and sound engineers Guy Mulladew and Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.